This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, your pop culture home.
Yeah, Frank here. He's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's the...
billiard room.
Come on already. We call it the...
The Place to Be.
Yes, the Place to Be. The Place to Be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Ugh. Time to play the game!
No, you left me satisfied and smiling.
That's what she said!
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be Podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola. Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
Japanese band Oral Vampire. Produced a song called The Repo Man and used footage.
Oral Vampire, huh?
Or Aural. A-U-R-A-L. What kind of show is this?
Sounds like some Twilight porn in Michael Lynch's collection there.
Oz went on to star in American Pie, of course. Is the lacrosse player. Bismarck. No, was it? Bismarck, wasn't that his
name? Bismarck.
Bismarck. No, who's the other guy I'm getting confused with?
Bismarck. Yeah, he dressed as North Dakota.
There's only one place where the big butts play, and that is in my extra queen-size bed. Well, it just happens. What can you do?
Let's talk the fix.
I didn't mean my, shock wall.
Is that the shock master's wall?
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I was just curious. PTB Nation, let me know what
you're
doing.
Our opener.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be Podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming at you live on this Monday evening inside the PTB Man Cave. We have a very interesting episode lined up for you here tonight. We have a couple guests going to be joining us, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But first, let me bring in my PIC, Mr. Scott Criscola. Scott, how you doing?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 277 of the Place to Be Podcast. And indeed, JR, very... kind of a unique episode tonight. Not really not like a hard topic per se, but kind of a meandering of thing of days gone by, our childhood and fun, things like that. But we are coming close to the end of the year. It's getting close to our favorite time of the year, JR, and that is, of course, Christmas time. And the big Christmas episode right around the corner.
Oof, coming fast.
Yeah, a lot of fun things. I think you'll like this year's PTB. I think you really will. And, of course, 23 episodes away from three bills. How did you handle the snow, Mr. Azzaro?
I shoveled it, and now it's gone.
I helped shovel. I don't have to shovel because I live in a complex, but I helped Dr. G shovel his, and a lot of ice. Ice is worse than the snow. The roads are not stellar in this part of New England, but... and of course, more on the way tomorrow, apparently, at least around here. I don't know if it's going to get all the way to you, but...
Yeah, I think we're supposed to get 1-3, which kind of sucks. It's a PC game tomorrow night.
I know.
And supposed to snow late afternoon, so I might kind of throw a wrench in things. But yeah, I was pretty beat yesterday. I did three driveways, myself, my parents, my mother-in-law's. So I earned my Picasso's food.
Yes.
And of course, you watched the TLC pay-per-view. Quite the crew there. Got the Cowboy, Roger Marcet, Mr. Flanagan, Mr. Richer, Mr. Dan McGinn. It's quite the party we had going on. It was a lot of fun. That'll be it for Picasso's for a while now, of course. We're going to be at the Rumble, and then Elimination Chamber seems far, far away. Now, Scott, we were actually supposed to have one guest on tonight, but Mr. Chad Campbell's off in a faraway land. Doing a little something kind of, I don't know. He's at a concert. No, I forgot to ask Chad if it's the Backstreet Boys. It was like a Christmas concert. Are they doing all the good Christmas hits? Are they doing the classics? Do they have new album? A lot of unanswered questions. We might need a special episode of the Brad and Chad Show where they just talk about the set list on the Backstreet Boys concert that Chad Campbell's at tonight.
That'd be tremendous.
I hope he gets the shirt.
Yes. Oh, of course. Well,
PSP,
you know, this is the
2013.
Yeah, this is the 90s version of One Direction, I suppose.
That's right.
And the 90s version of New Kids on the Block, which is
and now they toured with them a couple years ago, right?
Yes. Didn't your wife go?
Yes,
didn't
I think she did, go? Actually, yes.
I think didn't she go to see them?
Both most females do.
Yes, exactly, Chad.
So anyway, we do have two other guests on, much better than Chad Campbell, Scott. So why don't we go ahead and bring them in? And Scott, those guests, first off, he was here with us earlier this year, a couple months ago, talking about the awesome second edition of the WWE Encyclopedia, which, Scott, you have in hand for our show tonight.
Yes,
that
I do.
That is the one and only, the great Brian Shields. Brian, welcome back.
Hey, guys. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. Good to have you on.
Yeah, glad to have you back for sure. And we have some cool stuff planned. And anytime there's cool stuff planned and crazy gimmicks and wild wrestling talk, we have to bring in a longtime fan of Place to Be podcast and one of our staff star writers, a diamond in the rough, Scott, Mr. Steve Willey. Steve, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, thank you. I also have the first edition in hand as well. It helped me very much during our trivia contest earlier last year.
And you made the final, so you can see it really paid off.
The semis, but we can just say finals and we'll be happy about it.
All right, so what we thought we'd do today, and we got into this a little bit when you were on last time, Brian, where we kind of went off of these crazy tangents. We're talking about all different wrestlers, and obviously you did a ton of great research when you were looking up stuff for the book and some cool stories along the way. So we have a few games that Chad Campbell, who, by the way, I'm going to announce again, is at the Backstreet Boys concert tonight. That's why he couldn't join us. He came up with some games. Yeah, right. He came up with some games for us to play. And we have some cool things involving the encyclopedia that we're going to do. And then just talk about some gimmicks, some crazy gimmicks, some forgotten gimmicks, maybe different face and heel turns, guys that went under a lot of change, and anything in the weird, wacky world of wrestling history. So the first one I thought would be a cool idea is, actually, I'm going to turn it over to Steve Willey, because Steve, you had a few gimmicks that you looked up earlier today, right, that you wanted to kind of discuss and maybe you could do a little roundtable about. So why don't we do that, and then we'll get into some of the games.
Sure. Yeah, it was just some random ones I was looking at last night and this morning, things I remember from my childhood and my early days of wrestling, and one that I had a friend who asked about, too, who I honestly don't remember. But my first, one of my favorites as a kid, more because I was frightened of him, was the Missing Link. So he just had a cup of coffee in the WWF, but was around kind of Mid-South and around world class a little bit. What stuck out for me was just his wild look and his hair, and wondering how a guy like that could actually function in normal society, walking around with a big puffball of hair on his head and, you know, those two little puffballs coming out of his head. You guys have any specific memories of him at all, or?
I definitely remember the
Missing Link. You want me to start off?
Sure.
Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
I thank you. I have to tell you, my first memories of the Missing Link were actually seeing him on ESPN on Long Island. We used to get World Class Championship Wrestling. And I just thought he was this bizarre, scary-looking character who... I mean, Skandar Akbar brought him to the ring, and as I got older, I always wondered, like, you know, and Steve, I think you may have kind of alluded to this a little bit, but like, what's his Saturday morning like running errands? You know what I mean? Like, I mean, just you know, and he was definitely one of those also where when he wasn't in WWE, I was always like, oh, he'd make a really, really interesting character in WWE, probably, like, you know, I always thought of him as someone in, like, Mr. Fuji's stable. When he was there, I believe he was managed by Bobby Heenan. But yeah, he wasn't in WWE very long. And, you know, that was the thing with writing the encyclopedia was, you know, everything or, you know, was in the realm of their WWE career. But, yeah, definitely a great character of the 1980s. Dewey Robertson, he was known as before he transformed to Missing Link. And, yeah, just some great stuff in that headbutt off the top rope.
And he was active for 15 years before he even became that character. And that's obviously all I remembered him by. I remembered him from the early days of World Class. And then, yeah, he was only in the WWF for 6 months. Yeah, with Heenan and then Jimmy Hart. But yeah, I remember him mostly from World Class and WWF. But yeah, it was just an odd man, odd looking man, odd style. Just really stood out for the mid-80s.
I think the only way I really knew him was from the, I think we talked about this last time you were on, Brian, is that old George Napolitano book. I remember he was in there, and I knew him from that, but I didn't recall him in the WWF. I didn't start watching really till 1990, and I didn't really get a lot of World Class up here. I remember seeing the later days when it was on ESPN, but not very vivid memories. So, Scott, how about you?
Oh, I definitely remember him in both World Class and in WWF. It's funny, Steve, you said 6 months. It feels like he was there longer than that, but
yeah.
I remember him being in good shape. Like, usually the crazy looking guys back then were like a little flabby or kind of, you know, or just flat out big fat dudes. But Missing Link was pretty ripped. I mean, he was in good shape. He could go in a match. You know, he was a brawler. But I was kind of impressed at the time by for being in such good shape for that kind of character. Usually they're, you know, big fat dudes like Abdullah and stuff like that. So he didn't really have any overwhelming feuds. He might have fought Hogan maybe once on TV in like a house show match or something, but pretty much he was, you know, gimmick fodder. And he didn't lose much. And then he just left. It was really weird. I don't know where he went after that. But, yeah, one of the kind of more enigmatic characters in WWF history for a guy that wasn't around too long.
Okay, now, another guy, my friend Jamie had asked me to bring this guy up because I have no recollection of him whatsoever. And I think that, probably all three of you had, because he was on the original Saturday Night's Main Event. The Duke of Dorchester. It's a kind of a jobber.
Yeah. Yep. Duke Doherty.
Yeah. Pete Doherty.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, he was a local jobber, mainly like in the Northeast. He might have made the rounds a little bit too, but I definitely know he was from Massachusetts, Dorchester, Massachusetts, obviously. So he was always on the Boston Garden House shows, all the stuff you see like on 24/7. He's always there. And he did some commentary too, and it was terrible. On some house shows, he was just brutal. There was like one team was like him, Mike McGurk, and Bruce Pritchard. It was just awful to listen to, and they just
had this
awful gravelly voice, like Brian Shields, you know. And but Brian, what memories do you have of the Duke?
You know, I remember him kind of on TV, like you said, in that he was kind of a fixture in the Northeast wrestling scene, I think, for many years. And, you know, when WWE was running those shows really from, you know, like Connecticut up through New England, he always seemed to be on the card, especially on, you know, the Boston Garden shows. And, you know, his brief foray into announcing that you mentioned brought, I mean, it's now so vivid. I think it's on one of the Coliseum videos, where I don't remember which one, but there were a couple I remember hearing him on, with that, you know, with that trio of a Mike McGurk and Bruce Pritchard. And it was,
I remember what it was.
It was a Houston house show.
Yeah. It was like the Paul Bosch anniversary show or something like that.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's
and
it.
He was telling Mike McGurk to go in the kitchen and bake me a cake.
Yeah,
it was so embarrassing.
Oh, it was brutal.
Terrible.
What year do you think that would have been? Yeah. Like 86?
I think it was around that time. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even as a kid, I remember, and I would just, I mean, I was so into every single facet of like the program, anything related to it. I had my undivided attention. I just remember that as a kid being like, you know, why is this happening?
I'm looking up now on our find the history of WWE.com.
I found it,
Graham Cawthon. It was 87, I know, right?
Yeah, it is August 28th, 87, from Houston. Bruce Pritchard, Mike McGurk, and Pete Doherty in commentary. All right, so here are the matches. Sam Houston defeated Steve Lombardi, 13-56.
Oof.
Bruno Sammartino defeated Hercules in an international wrestling challenge in 647.
International?
Yes.
Italy against Rome or whatever?
So. Andre the Giant was introduced briefly and then left when he was heavily booed. Brutus Beefcake defeated Johnny V, 636 in a hair match. Tom Pritchard defeated Mark Lewin in 258. Hulk Hogan defeated the One Man Gang, 1013. Sherry Martel beat Fabulous Moolah at 6:47, and Brian, that is on the Women of WWF Coliseum home video, so it might have been more matches you saw. Junkyard Dog and Tony Atlas defeated Sika and Kamala at 5:41. Is it interesting?
A main event anywhere in the country, right there.
Yes, and actually, this one may be. Terry Funk defeated Chavo Guerrero in 7 minutes.
Wow.
Ted DiBiase defeated Jim Duggan at 8:30. Good. And Mil Mascaris and Tito Santana defeated Demolition at 5:56.
Wow.
And apparently that DiBiase-Duggan match, it was because of the quality of this bout that Duggan was able to reclaim his job in the WWF following his release earlier in the year due to the drug charges. So, interesting there. I'm going to have to rewatch that show. I know I have it on tape somewhere from 24/7. But
yeah, it's one of our earlier tapes, I think.
You know, while we're on the Coliseum topic, Brian, what was your all-time favorite Coliseum video from, like, the old run?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. Probably, I mean, that Best of WWF series, I think, is just phenomenal. And it's probably that first one, that Volume 1 with Snuka on the cover.
Yes.
They have the big main event tag as from the Meadowlands of... Hogan and Andre joining forces to take on Stud and the then tag champs Adonis and Murdoch. That's probably my favorite. A close second would be the first Unusual Matches. The Coliseum was awesome. That was when I saw, that was the first time a lot of people outside of the New York area saw the Jimmy Snuka dive onto Don Morocco from Madison Square Garden. Mm-hmm. And I loved a lot of the wrestler specific, like Hulkamania's 1 and 2, the British Bulldogs.
The Piper one is, I think the Piper one's one of the best.
Piper one is phenomenal. The Bulldogs, Hart Foundation. I mean, so many. There was a period there where those Coliseum videos were, I mean, to me, just tremendous.
Here's what was on that, the Best of the WWF Volume 1. You got that first match right, Brian. Hogan and Andre against Stud, Adonis and Murdoch in a handicap match. That match was 22 minutes.
Wow.
22-21. Yeah. Wendy Richter pinned Moolah, the big upset, 7-23-84 at the Garden when she won the women's title. Jimmy Snuka beat Bobby Bass. Piper beat Snuka. Cobra pinned Black Tiger for the junior heavyweight title. Hogan and Mean Gene against George Animal Steel and Mr. Fuji. It probably included those unbelievably hideous warm-up videos where Mean Gene's drinking eggs and yes. Some other nonsense.
Yeah, I think those were on there.
And then the last two were part of that awesome Bruno Zabisco feud. The first match they had in Allentown in January of 80, and then, of course, the cage match at Shea Stadium.
And so. You know what I love about that Piper tape, too, is not only just, I mean, they have that awesome thing where he interviews himself. They have the Halloween from Saturday's Main Event, where he's eating the candy and the they trick him with the tamales and everything. But it has a lot on the whole Snuka Tonga Kid and that whole feud.
Mm-hmm.
And those matches, the heat was just incredible for some of those matches. And I just that was like an eye opener when I watched that on 24/7. I was like, holy shit, this is like some of the hottest matches I've ever seen in my life. The Snuka and Tonga Kid and Orton and all that stuff. Brian, do you agree with that feud in particular?
Oh yeah, I mean the Piper stuff, and it's so funny because if you look at the stuff he did before he got to WWE, I mean you could tell that he was going to do things that really transcend wrestling. And to me, when he got to WWE, that's exactly what he did. I mean the stuff with Snuka was. I mean, it was unbelievable. And I think at that time, you know, I think the Superfly needed that also because, you know, his feud with Morocco was unbelievable. And I think at the time it was almost like, well, how can you beat that? And then Piper came and it was just, it took things to a whole other level.
Hmm. How about you, Steve? What are some of your favorite Coliseum videos?
So we didn't ever, and this is where I'm totally jealous about 24/7. And I do hope there is a network because we can't get that up here where I live. But I remember getting them from my local library, a couple of them. So I remember the Unusual Matches one. I actually remember them having more of the NWA tapes and this was 84, 85, 86, so those original Starcade tapes. But there were very few. I think there were a couple of best of WWFs. But then there were just, you know, randoms that you'd come up in the video store over the years. And I think in the best of WWF series, some of these more specialty ones, like that were strictly, you know, one, with the exception of maybe Hulk Hogan, I remember that one. British Bulldogs, like the Hart Foundation, we never got those around where I lived.
I remember my first, the first one I ever watched was the, well, the first one was WrestleMania 1.
Right.
And then the first couple of best ofs, including the one, Brian, you were talking about, that volume one, which had the Hogan-Andre match is real. I mean, Andre was so over, and obviously Hogan was too. That crowd was crazy too. But I remember the first Hulkamania tape, not because of the matches, although the match he had with Greg Valentine at the Spectrum was really good. There's a piece probably from TNT where Hogan's making like the Python shake. And all of a sudden, he starts pulling out these little baggies full of pills. And you're like this little kid, and you're like, oh, that's kind of cool, vitamins. Meanwhile, we're realizing what the hell they really are. Diana Ball and God only knows what else. But it's really funny. Like, oh, then you got to take these, and I had a bag of like 50 pills. I'm like, what? What's going on here?
That was always egg yolks and
yes, egg yolks and Diana Ball or whatever the hell it was. Or Nandrolone or whatever the hell was in there.
What champions are made of. I think one of my favorites is they're really a lot from like the 92 range. Smack 'em, Whack 'em, of course, has the Bret Flair title change and the Bret Shawn ladder match. That was like a holy grail when I found that. It was at a flea market in Florida. I came across that one. Invasion 92 had some good matches. I think it had Shawn and Flair. And, well, so there was a couple of Flair matches on that one that were pretty good. And then Super Tape 4. So one of the No Holds Barred Cage match. Those are some of my early favorites of Coliseum video. But it was just cool to go in and to see all those there. So, a time that's really hard to ever explain. And, you know, we tried to capture a little bit when Jen and Engel and I did the We Missed the 90s video stores thing. And I don't know. It's like if you didn't grow up in that time period, it's hard to really grasp what it was like to go rent videos. But
Well, I think one of the things, because I loved that article, and having a sister that's much younger than I am, it seems like the younger generation today, If anything like came before them, they're almost not interested in it.
Right.
And that's something that, and I find that alarming in a lot of ways, just in general. But I think especially like with WWE and the great history of professional wrestling in general in the United States. The stuff that's going on today is great, and it's great to watch, and that it's so accessible to find everything out. I almost feel like it makes it even more of a shame, you know, where like a lot of the younger, you know, a lot of the younger fans, you know, that are, I guess, up to maybe like, you know, early 20s, young adults, it's like, you know, if they don't know it because they saw it live, they're not always interested in it.
And I think that's such a shame, too, like you said, because it's I get in this argument with people all the time when they say, oh, the current product stinks, you know, like that, you know, the kind of the groupthink of the Internet. When I really argue there is no better time to be a wrestling fan than right now, that because of all that access we have to the past and the present, you know, any indie federation, you pretty much have either access to DVDs or video on demand or iPay-per-views. Within days, and if you want to look up something else with YouTube, you know, or you know, the 24/7, or you can have that kind of access instantly. So I have a hard time saying, well, it's a bad time to be a wrestling fan, and I think that goes across other cultures too. And spent a lot of time Place of Nation talking about comic books, and there's a great article today on how it's the golden age of comic books because of all the newer things and the easy access to older titles.
Yeah, I mean, and back, you know, in the 90s or late 80s, early 90s, all these other promotions, and you mentioned the indies of Steve, and those were like magical kingdoms that you never see. You know, this, you only live through these magazines, like, oh, what's going on in Memphis? I can only learn through the words in these magazines. I wasn't able to see it, or I didn't know what half the guys were, and it was like a whole other world. This is, you know, freaking miles and miles away, and without that, without that access that you have at your fingertips was just, it left so much more to the imagination. And like you said, Steve, it's quite the time to be a fan. But then there's also a little bit of that mystique, and I think maybe that's what you're kind of getting at, Brian, a little bit. Some of that mystique of either those magazines or renting those tapes or discovering something. I mean, there are tapes of pay-per-views and TV shows that I just watched over and over and over and over and over again because that's all I had. You know, I only had Survivor Series 89, so I've seen it a million times. You know, I taped live the whole year of Raw from 96 through early 98, and I watched those tapes so many times because I didn't have anything else. So I have, like, those April, May, June 96 Raws just burnt into my memory. And just such a different time. That's the best way to explain it, I think. All right, Steve, who's your next gimmick you have here lined up for us?
Okay, this is more of a current one. ECW came around. I grew up in Chicago area, and then I went to school in Milwaukee. And ECW kind of started coming there live towards the end, I'd say. And one of our favorites, just because it was so bad, it was good, were Simon Diamond and his... We would just call him his Merry Band of Misfits. I don't even know if he had a name for his group. It would just be whatever random Zon they had in the back, pretty much. They had a musketeer with a sword. Prodigy, who was someone. Prodigette, who was like the Prodigy's twin sister. Johnny Swinger came along for a while. Just a bunch of misfits. And, you know, you wonder where these people came from as well. Were they like Paul Heyman's neighbors or, you know, his accountant or... Yeah, a lot of the whole late days of ECW were filled with some of these characters who, you looking back, you understand now why they went under. Like Bilvis Wesley was another one.
Yes. I think a lot of it was just, yes, their talent leaving, and they were just trying to fill the card up with some of these guys. I mean, you were obviously in the New York area. Did you watch a lot of ECW, Brian?
I did. I was a huge fan of ECW back even when it was Eastern Championship Wrestling. The MSG Network, Madison Square Garden Network, here in the New York area in the early 90s, on Friday and Saturday nights, if I'm remembering this correctly, used to turn into Prime Sports, which was a Philadelphia sports cable network. And that's how a lot of people in the New York area first became familiar with ECW. Mm-hmm. So I was a huge ECW fan. And then when I was in the video game business at Acclaim, we made the two ECW video games.
Oh, that's right.
So, you know, it was a great, unfortunately, for the fans, myself included, the games did not live up to what people wanted them to be, but I have to tell you, the great experience that I got and great memories of working with people from ECW was just awesome. And I remember that Anarchy Rules pay-per-view from Chicago. I think it was in 99 or 2000. It was I think they did like over 7,000 people at that event. That was one of their most popular pay-per-view events. And that was one of the events that we were using because we would get tapes of all the shows. And that was a one of the events that we were using to kind of educate retailers and members of the video game press and some other people on, you know, like who ECW was. And at the time, like, they were on the rise and, you know, things like that. So yeah, huge ECW fan.
I was at that show, actually. One of the 7,000 in attendance.
Excellent.
And I remember like the ramp that they had, and I mean, it was a really cool, just the show looked great. I thought it was definitely one of those where I wish I could have been there.
Yeah, and it's amazing, like, when you can look back at that time period, how quickly it then fell, because you were, you know, I think that was 99, and, you know, less than 2 years later, it was completely done.
I mean, it's weird to think at the time that ECW seemed, you know, early 01, late 2000, like maybe more likely to survive than WCW, which is just mind blowing when you think about where they were just 2 years before. But ECW seemed, maybe it was just all we're drinking the Heyman Kool-Aid. It just never seemed like it would die, no matter what. Even when the show started getting canceled, you figured at some point they'd find their way back. And I don't think it was until Heyman showed up on Raw that everyone really just accepted it was done. I can't say I saw a lot of it at the time. I really didn't start seeing a lot of it until it was on TNN. We just didn't get it locally here, at least that I was aware of. So it was later on that I really gained an appreciation for it. So part of me always wished I was in that area. I was stuck watching local public access backyard wrestling at midnight on Saturdays instead of ECW. So a little bit of a drop.
I mean, it was such an interesting time where, like, I remember the crew would come to Acclaim and we would do like mocap shoots, like motion capture shoots and like photo sessions, and the talent would record little promos for like the editor at Game Informer and the editor at IGN or the buyer at Toys R Us. And, you know, I remember like, I mean, we did them with like the Dudleys, we did them with Taz and Lance Storm and so many of these guys where, you know, eventually, like I remember the Dudleys having to be taken out of the original ECW video game. And we were able to keep Taz in, but we could only have him as a hidden character in the game. So that was a real interesting time, I think, in wrestling history for sure. And like you guys said, I mean, like, it's like WCW just kind of went away, and, you know, I mean, there's some people that, you know, still care about it and some that don't, but like, if you go online today and read about the way people write and remember ECW, if you didn't know any better, you would think it's still on TV today, like with new content.
Right.
And that's a huge achievement for Paul Heyman and Todd Gordon and Tommy Dreamer and all the, you know, the men and women that worked in ECW for sure.
And it's crazy to think too. I mean, TNA has now surpassed ECW's run, which is mind-boggling to me because that they're still going, and you know, ECW seemed to have such a long life at the time. let me ask you this, Brian, because this interests me. We didn't get into a lot last time. Your time at Acclaim. So, what were all the games while you were there that you worked on, wrestling-wise?
Well, I started out working on the WWF Warzone, which was on the PlayStation 1, Nintendo 64, and the Game Boy. That was the one with Stone Cold on the cover by himself.
Yep.
I was there. I was, you know, starting my career actually as a marketing intern for the sports marketing group. And so during that time, I was like pulling game footage for commercials, submissions to WWE for approvals, screenshots, things along those lines. And then the next year was WWF Attitude. And that was the red packaging that had like Stone Cold, Undertaker, Mankind, The Rock, Triple H.
And that game, I remember that kept getting pushed back by a few weeks because I was waiting, the day would come, and then it got delayed. And I just was like, I'm losing my mind. I wanted it so bad, so badly.
Yeah,
and I remember
August
it finally came out, late August.
Yeah, that game was really heavily anticipated. And, you know, in a lot of ways, that game set the bar for wrestling games of that generation,
yeah.
Specifically with the attention to detail in the models, all the depth in the game modes.
I love the calendar.
Wrestler.
How you'd work like Heat, and then you'd work up to Raw, and then the pay-per-view.
Yeah, I mean, it was so well done, and that was from the Acclaim Salt Lake Studios at the time. And, you know, those guys just did they just did an amazing job on those games. And it really set the tone, you know, for wrestling games. You know, and then the two ECW games, Hardcore Revolution and Anarchy Rules. And then a game that was created while I was at Acclaim was a game called Legends of Wrestling. And that was a franchise that saw, you know, legends from
yep.
all the different eras and all the different promotions under one banner, and we got three games out of that series, and then about a month after the last one shipped, the company unfortunately, you know, filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which, you know, means that, you know, the doors are closing. And it's funny because one of you guys brought it up before how a lot of people just didn't believe that ECW was ever going to close. And that once Paul Heyman appeared on Raw, that was when it was, you know, clear to everybody. And it was funny because even like the executives at Acclaim back then, you know, there were a group of us that worked for the company that, you know, that were also very big wrestling fans. And we were, you know, reading the internet and like so many others. And, you know, there was this group inside Acclaim that were, you know, telling the higher ups, like, you know, listen, it doesn't look good, you know, and so on and so on. And they just weren't interested in it, or they chose to ignore it, or whatever it was. But finally, when, you know, when Paul Heyman was on Raw, that was when the company, I don't know, I guess, believed us, I guess is the most simplest way to put it, was that, you know, that ECW was, you know, was no more. Because Acclaim owned 15%,
right,
minority equity interest in ECW. So it was a very interesting time, you know, in wrestling and in the gaming business. If you followed wrestling video games, like Acclaim lost the WWE license, it got ECW, THQ got the WWE license and did, you know, wonderful things with the brand. And EA Sports released a couple of, you know, what I would say is forgettable WCW titles. So
Backstage Assault, wasn't that one of theirs? That awful
Backstage, yeah. Yeah, Backstage Assault and then Mayhem. So
yep.
Yeah, definitely a very interesting time for wrestling video gamers.
And those Legends games were really cool. I remember, like, because Lawler was in it, right? So you had Lawler and was Hogan. He came in later, right? Was he not in the first one? He was in a later one or something. Am I remembering that?
He was in all three.
Was he? Okay. Wasn't there someone that came in later that they couldn't get for the first one, and then they got later on?
Is it Warrior?
Yeah. The Andre the Giant came in for Legends 2 and was in Showdown, and Ultimate Warrior, Sting, Macho Man and Jake the Snake Roberts were some of the, at the time, the new announced talent for the last game was Showdown Legends of Wrestling.
Okay,
and, you know, working with the talent and signing them from a marketing and intellectual property standpoint was something that was, you know, part of my day-to-day responsibility. You know, I'm thinking back, like Dusty Rhodes, DDP, there were a lot of, you know, that last game had a lot of new talent. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, like a lot of the games at the time from Acclaim, you know, during those last years of the company, you know, they just, the games were not what consumers had hoped. So it was, that was bittersweet at the time, you know, especially that last game. I mean, you have a package front of Hulk Hogan looking at Andre the Giant, Ultimate Warrior, Sting, Randy Macho Man Savage, and Jake the Snake Roberts. And then, you know, and then you flip the back of it and you see Eddie Guerrero, DDP, Roddy Piper, Bret Hart, the Road Warriors, you know, Big Papa Pump. I'm probably leaving a couple of people off inadvertently. You know what I mean? So the games had a lot of potential. People really liked the concept of them. You know, unfortunately, in the end, the products themselves just didn't deliver.
And it's interesting because it came out at a very good time, right? Because the first one was, what, like 02, 03-ish? And that's when the nostalgia kick was really starting to come in, especially in wrestling, and I think in culture in general. You know, Hogan came back to WWF. And it just seemed like everyone was starting to get a little bit nostalgic for the early 90s at that point. So those games came out at probably the best time possible outside of like now where nostalgia is just over the top. But I feel like they timed it well.
They came out at a great time. You know, one of the things, guys, with video game systems still is, you know, how many people own the systems, and, you know, how many people own the systems, and how commercially viable is your product? You know, how good of a chance do you have to really sell a product? And, you know, at that time, the PS2 especially was just, I mean, just selling major, major units. And that was your mass market video game platform at the time. And, you know, Hulk Hogan was our spokesman. And I remember the launch very well. It was December of 2001 was the first game. You know, unfortunately, you know, something that Acclaim came to be known for a little bit was missing their original date. So the game was late originally. But that first month up against NBA Live, NHL, Madden, and Grand Theft Auto 3, that first month, I think we sold almost 200,000 pieces. Hmm. At a premium, at the time, a PS2 premium price point was $49.99. And we had a TV commercial with Hulk Hogan. I remember, you know, being there and flying down to Tampa and shooting that with him. You know, Jerry Lawler was in the game. We had, you know, so it was definitely something that people were interested in. It's actually funny. I was supposed to book. I was doing a PR tour with Bret Hart in Canada in July of 2004. And I came back and we were supposed to book a developer tour of wrestling developers in Japan for the next series of Legends games. Because I always wanted to have Aki develop it. So
they were the best, right?
You know,
they were
the No Mercy and
WCW
really 2000, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so that's what I, from the day of, okay, we're going to do a game called Legends, that was the developer that I always wanted to do the game. And, you know, finally, you know, we had the executive approval to actually go to Japan and meet with them. And we were about to book the trip, and someone told one of the executives, one of the marketing executives, you know, hold off on booking it. And, you know, 2 weeks later we were out of business. So it was one of those things where, it was a real honor for me to be able to work on the project and with, you know, so many great legends and things like that. So it was a huge deal at the time. And, but you know, it's all history, as they say now. And I mean, this summer Acclaim will be closed 10 years. So that's a long time.
It's crazy. And the attitude, I remember, was, like you said, that really started the run. And I remember just creating, it was just a whole world worth of guys in that with the creative wrestler for that one. It was so detailed, like you said. And they had all the great theme songs, too, the kind of custom-made theme songs. And that was one of the first games where you could cycle through and just listen to the songs. And those were great for us because I just cycled through, listened to the whole theme, and I love that part of it. Because those weren't easily accessible at the time.
Guys, the Warzone and Attitude games were so well done. And, I mean, even the audio. I mean, you know, you go back now and listen to the audio in those games. Even on a cartridge and then on the Nintendo 64, which now just to probably a lot of your listeners sounds so ridiculous. But, you know, I mean, at that time, it was a huge deal to get that kind of audio quality on a cartridge. Mm-hmm. Those games were really well done. I was a speck of sand on a beach in terms of, you know, people that worked on them. I mean, I was just beginning my career at the time. But I mean, those games were so well done, and everybody that worked on those games, whether it was product development, you know, quality assurance, marketing, PR, you name it. I mean, everybody just did a great, great job on those games.
And the ring entrances, too, were a big part of those first couple, because they were really the first games to have, like, full entrances with the theme. I think Attitude really had – I think Warzone had, like, half entrances where they kind of come down the aisle and it would flash. But I think Attitude was the first one that had, like, full-fledged – because they had Gangrel coming up and a lot of those guys. So they actually walked fully down the aisle and into the ring.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it really set a bar. I mean, it was kind of like – Madden football for wrestling. It was like it had every detail, you know. Those games were really well done, and the ECW games were made on the same engine, and unfortunately the developers were not given the proper development time and resources to make the game the way that they wanted to in terms of making it really specific for ECW. And, you know, that was a difficult thing at the time.
It was essentially the same game as the other two, mm-hmm. with all, you know, specifically made creator wrestlers for ECW. I do remember the slight disappointment of that, but the sheer hours that could be had on your own, like you said, Justin, making your own creator wrestlers.
Oh, yeah. We pretty much had the whole ECW roster and Attitude anyway. And then I was in the prime position. I had a roommate that loved wrestling as much as I did in college. We were sophomores going, you know, junior year, sophomore year. And this was like, these games coming out at that point was just fantastic. So that was, you know, a lot of time killed playing those games. And I was building custom guys and custom cards, so... all right, Scott, you got the encyclopedia there. So, Steve Willie, pick a page number, and we will have, first off, Brian. See how well you know your own book. See if you can guess any of the superstars on the page, because that'll be insanely impressive. Insanely impressive if you can pull this off. And then we'll talk about one of the gimmicks that Scott picks off the page. So, Steve, pick a number.
Okay, I'm going to pick one that I'm interested in myself. 194.
Okay.
Okay.
194.
I can give a clue. What the?
Oh God!
Well.
I know which one you wanted. I know what you're talking about.
There's
three. There's three on the page.
One of the people on the page is actually quite timely.
Yes, because he passed away recently. That person is Mad Dog Vachon, who of course passed away about a month ago.
Okay.
The other one is Mae Young.
I think you guys missed the point of the game, but go ahead.
Yeah, I understand it. I was just giving the clue that one was timely.
Okay.
We're going to have Brian guess. All right, Scott, let's see who's on the page.
All right, Brian, there's
I agree.
All right, Brian, there was one more on the page.
The one I wanted to know was the other one that Scott did not say.
Yeah, there's one more on the page, Brian. We at least know what letter we're on, so.
Oh, it's she wasn't there that long. Mad Maxine.
Yes.
Yes.
I went through this book, and that was like the, you know, some of the 60s and 70s. I don't know. It was before my time, but that was the one I've just not the slightest idea of that happening.
Well, here's Brian's entry. In the book. Although she only competed in a handful of WWE matches, Mad Maxine will forever be remembered as one of the most frightening females to ever lace up a pair of boots. She really wasn't that frightening. Standing at an astonishing 6'4", 6'7", if you include her bright green mohawk, and sporting demonic eye makeup, Maxine instilled instant fear into her competition. Brought into WWF by Fabulous Moolah, Maxine's sole responsibility was to strip Wendy Richter of the Women's Championship. Before the highly anticipated encounter could ever take place, she mysteriously left.
All right, Brian, did you actually see some footage of Mad Maxine, or what led to the entry here?
I think it was, if I remember right, it was just like different articles that we saw, and I want to say a conversation with Howard Finkel. Because he is the resident, I mean, really, like almost historian at WWE. I mean, if I worked at WWE, I mean, Howard Finkel would probably call security on me every day for not leaving him alone. And I'd ask him questions all day. He wouldn't be able to get his work done. It would be incredibly awkward. But yeah, that was one of those entries, guys, where, you know, they were there, so they're on the list, and you know, you try and get as much accurate information as you can to put an entry together. You know what I mean? Because there wasn't a lot, you know, there wasn't a lot of information on her. So, you try and cross-reference her with Mula and what Mula was doing at a certain time and, you know, things like that. So.
All right, Steve, let's pick a new page.
All right. I'll just go random on this one. About 162.
Okay.
Hmm. 162.
Okay. All right. I won't say if anything. There are four guys on the page. I'll give you this hint, Brian. We're in the J's. So there's four guys on the page. So we'll give you a little hint because this is pretty random. One was a wrestler who became a manager. One is a former announcer that is not with the company anymore. One is a retired guy from the 70s and early 80s who was Canadian. And the other is a guy from Brooklyn who I guess you could say was a glorified jobber.
Jeez.
JR, feel free to help out since you're the only other one without a book. So
this is a tough one for me, guys.
So you said it was an announcer. It begins with J, an announcer that's no longer with the company.
Yeah, all J's. Yes, one is an announcer.
Is it Jim Ross?
It is not Jim Ross.
The coach. That would be. I feel like I need to step in here. Yeah.
Coachman. Yes, Jonathan Coachman. Jonathan Coachman is the former announcer.
Oh, okay.
Johnny Valent, Joe Sladuk, and Jose Estrada. A whole mishmash. I mean, these would be ones that you'd really have to go into the archives for. You know, Mad Maxine, you said, has, you know, you'd have to go off of Finkel, but like. Some of these are obviously before your time as well, right, Brian? Like Leduc, Estrada?
Estrada a little bit. I mean, by the time I was watching, he was definitely enhancement at the time. Joe Leduc, you know, it was funny because we were talking earlier about Missing Link and Cups of Coffee in WWE. I mean, I think Joe Leduc would definitely, you know, have his cup of Joe with him as well, no pun intended. Because yeah. I remember him in WWE very, very briefly, like in the late 80s. And, I mean, Luscious Johnny Valiant, you know, I mean, but when I was watching... he was really more of a manager at that point. You knew about the Valiant brothers, and at the time, his big claim to fame was the manager of the Dream Team. You know, Greg the Hammer Valentine and Brutus Beefcake. So you know, and we all know the coach, and he's actually done some really good stuff with ESPN.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his own radio show.
Yeah, he's really good on the radio.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a good call, guys. Good page on that one.
I wonder if a guy JR, like...
Actually, wait, Mr. Willie. Yeah. JR, Jose Leduc, or Joe Leduc actually has two very interesting facts pertaining to your fandom.
Yes.
Number one, he was in No Holds Barred.
Nice. I knew that.
And number two, he was managed by Frenchie Martin.
Oh, I prefer Jose Leduc in that instance, like you said. Steve, what are you going to say?
Oh, no, I actually don't. Oh, Coachman. Like, I wonder if he's a guy who looks back fondly upon his WWF time, like as a stepping stone.
I think he definitely does.
It's a constantly.
Yeah, he does on his radio show, and he uses wrestling themes. He plays, like, it's time to play the game every day and stuff. So he definitely uses a lot of wrestling music, and he does reference it. He does seem like he enjoyed his time and speaks well of it, which is good because I always liked the coach. We used to run into a member, Scott, at Bobby V's.
Yes, constantly.
Stanford. We'd run into him there. Yep. And right before me and Mark Claire ran into him, right before he was when he was in the feud with him and Al Snow against Lawler and JR, and they were trying to take over Raw, and we were just like pumping them up all through dinner. We kept like walking by, or we'd yell over like, "Coach, you're gonna kick their ass. You're gonna be the new man on Raw." And you know, he was all getting all into it. So it was a cool little memory from my brief time in Stanford. And I didn't get to see too many WWF guys there, but Coach was one I saw quite a few times, bumming around. All right, Brian, let me ask you this. Here's a good one for you. Any gimmicks that you thought could have worked or at least had a longer run that just kind of failed and you were a little bit disappointed by it? Or Steve. Yeah, it was Brian. Or either of you.
Ones that I thought.
Well, we can put it in two categories.
Better, or...
Yeah, ones that you thought maybe could have done better, or ones that you wanted personally just selfishly to see last longer. Maybe it wouldn't have drawn money or anything, but you just kind of liked the gimmick, and it didn't last as long as you would have liked.
I got to think about this one.
All right, Steve, you got any?
Besides Fantasio?
Yes, and the Jinx Brothers. I mean, I loved like Big Bully Busick. Like that's what that was one at the time that I wished he had way too short of a lifespan for me.
Oh, this stuff, Scott. Do you have one off the top of your head?
Friar Ferguson? No,
no, it's not a good one.
this is not the Matt Rotella show.
I can imagine that Bash and Booger was a step up in gimmicks for him. That was like went from being Friar Ferguson to Bash and Booger.
I would have liked to have seen more of the Freebirds. I don't know how, you know, how well they, you know, I love the Freebirds. So, I mean, to me, I don't know what would have happened with them in WWE in the mid 80s when they were there for a little while. But I definitely, that was one where I was always like, I wonder what would have happened there. There are a couple of people. I mean, we talk sometimes about people asking you about the encyclopedia, and you know, like I would have loved to have seen like Muda and Sting and Liger in WWE. I would have loved to have seen Brody come back in the late 80s. But yeah, I think one that was there that I would have liked to have seen a little more of would definitely be the Freebirds. I was always curious about Missy's Manor. I mean, it really became like a fabled,
kind of
a thing. So I think that's another one for sure.
I can't believe Vince let her get away.
You know, and it's one of those things where, like, I haven't asked about it in a long time, but I never found out, like, why, you know, and I've just always been very curious because, you know, I mean, she was gorgeous, and she did really well on the microphone in other places. I mean, if you look at her work in Mid-South, if you look at her work at the time with the Fullers and, in CWA, and then later in the early 90s and late 80s and early 90s in WCW. So I was always very curious, like, oh, why didn't it, you know, because she certainly had the look for WWE, you know?
Absolutely. And that segment was kind of ahead of its time. I mean, it was fairly risque, and I know she wanted a lot of money, and I think she was jealous. What was this? This was, what, in 86, early 87. I know she was. She had issues with Elizabeth. You know, they were like, you know, kind of rivals for the hottest girl in the promotion, kind of thing. So I think a lot of it was ego that led to her dismissal, which usually isn't something Vince that bugs Vince. You know what I mean? Like, he usually doesn't care about that kind of thing. But that's what I remember about Missy, that she didn't is why she didn't stick around. I think a lot of it was money.
How about the great, and this is going to be a selfish plug for the article I did, but the great Ludwig Borga. He had a short run, you know, came in at 93 and was instantly one of the top heels, and then just got hurt and never resurfaced. I'm surprised they didn't try and bring him back. I know he went a little nuts, and then he went to Parliament, and then he killed himself. But seems like a guy that Vince may would have tried to bring back a couple years later with maybe a different gimmick, just based on his look.
I'm trying to think of
stunned by that question.
If everyone looks away, the other way, it might go away.
Shut up, Steve Willie. I don't think anyone's ever written as brilliantly besides Brian and the Encyclopedia and my article about Ludwig Borga. Steve, who's your like guilty pleasure gimmick? A guy that you'd kind of embarrassed to say you like, but just because it's such a goofy premise.
This isn't totally guilty because he's kind of respected for his wrestling ability, but Hakushi was a huge fan of mine. I was a huge fan of his when he was in WWE, and that kind of, he was a guy who really opened up my eyes to other types of wrestling. And I say it's a guilty pleasure because he's such a, you know, the character of WWF, it's kind of, you know, a tad racist in a way, you know, just the way he's kind of portrayed in outfit and everything like that. So I say that'd be a guilty pleasure in terms of, you know, how he is dressed and how he was portrayed on screen. But I was, you know, just kind of flipping through here, and he was only around for a year, but, you know, while he was there, you know, some of the matches with Bret Hart, 1-2-3 Kid, and, you know, with him, I was kind of jump-started, you know, trading and like Japanese tapes and stuff like that, learning about Michinoku Pro and some of the, and again, I was in college then as well. So, you know, having the internet and being able to trade tapes and that.
Any more or less racist than Kenzo Sasaki's original gimmick where he was supposed to be Hirohito, remember? Emperor Hirohito?
Oh.
And that got shot down like immediately. He didn't even make TV. They did all the promos, and then I think they realized how awful it was. And then they took him off of there.
There was an article on Slate.com a couple weeks ago, and I meant to bring this up earlier, on Hans Schmidt, who was a wrestler in the 50s and 60s. And he was portrayed straight up as a Nazi. And like, can you imagine? And he wasn't even German. He was French-Canadian, of course, which is, you know, typical wrestling for you. You know, can you imagine something like that today? People are getting up in arms, and as well they should. You know, some of Zeb Coulter's discussions, as you know, his monologues as he comes to the ring, or like you said, Kenzo Suzuki, or that, like, how, you know, so openly jingoistic and just, you know, going for the cheap heat. I think it was the article on Slate was from Justin Shoemaker or David Shoemaker's book that came out, like The Squared Circle, I think it was called.
Brian, who are some of the craziest gimmicks you learned about? Were there any that you just were shocked to read or had completely forgotten when you were doing the encyclopedia?
Battlecast for sure was one at the time where I totally forgot about him. So that one for sure jumped out at me. Friar Ferguson, Fantasio, Mystery Man, one that we put in the second edition, Who.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then some of the stuff I really loved reconnecting with, though, were, you know, the guys that you saw every week, you know, whether it was, you know, Iron Mike Sharp or Barry Horowitz, or, you know, some of the, you know, Terry Gibbs, you know, some of these, some of the guys that just, you know, it's like you saw them every week, and, you know, they were busting their, you know, you know what's to, you know, to help build, other wrestlers, you know, So that's the stuff where it was kind of fun for me to be reminded of, you know, who was in WWE.
And really, if you think about it, those guys that you mentioned, Barry O is another one that popped in my head when you were mentioning those names, were on TV in terms of syndication more often than the celebrity, or the big guys, the big names. They were on every week, a guy like Iron Mike Sharp. I'm sure they were at the tapings doing 2-3 matches an evening.
Tiger Chung.
Yeah, and it was interesting also because in Canada and in Japan, Iron Mike Sharp was like a huge deal. I mean, like if you go back and to different events and different cards that he was on, I mean, he was a well respected wrestler. I always enjoyed watching him, you know, and his signature was a little like that black leather wristband almost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he was great, you know, so the encyclopedia definitely, you know, I learned about a lot of people. I'm thinking back now to like a Crusher Verdue, you know, from the 1960s and 70s, or, you know, so there were like so many that I learned about that I never heard of, or, you know, read an article or two on. And then there were so many that I reconnected with, you know, after forgetting about them, you know, for years. Because it is one of those things where, you know, as a fan, you enjoy it. Like, you know, there's no off season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think once you start working within the industry in some way or on a product side, you know, you appreciate that even more because it's, you know, it's 365 days a year. I mean, so like you said before, you know, during the TV syndication days, you were seeing a lot of Iron Mike Sharp, which is pretty impressive.
He was Canada's greatest athlete.
Yes.
Yeah, naturally.
Yeah. Guys like Tiger Chung Lee and Rene Goulet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Outback, no, not really Outback Jack. He was like a glorified. Well, he was. I guess he was a low tier superstar slash enhancement jobber. Who's the other? Who's the other guy, JR, that you always liked? The other like explorer guy. It was like the mid-90s.
Explorer.
That was his name, or maybe he wasn't an explorer. He was like a kind of like an Outback Jack. Oh, Buck Quartermain, right? Was that his name?
No, I don't. You're all over the place.
Was there a wrestler, Buck Quartermain?
Yeah, there was, yes. But he wasn't a... He was just like a jobber that did...
Oh, okay. I thought he was a...
He was kind of young at the time, Dirty F, and then he went on to do like a lot of indie work and stuff. There was Buck Zumhoff, but he wasn't an explorer.
Rock and roll Buck Zumhoff.
That's right. Brian, do you remember the rumored Demolition reboot in like 94? Crush came out after he turned heel, and he was like in the... They did a taping. I don't think it made TV. He came out in the Demolition regalia. And there were rumors that him and Brian Clark were going to reform Demolition in like 94, and then it never went anywhere. Do either of you guys remember reading that?
Vaguely do, because that was that after Atom Bomb or before Atom Bomb?
It would have been during Atom Bomb.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it was 94, 95-ish. It was somewhere in there. There's a rumor they were going to come back as Demolition. Do you remember anything about that, Brian?
That I don't remember. That I'd like to learn more about, because I was a Demolition fan, so I'd definitely like to hear more about that. That would have been very interesting at the time.
I think I read it in those old Herb Kuhn's tidbits. Remember those? He was like he used to basically, you know, rip off the dirt sheets and post them on like the Usenet or whatever. But go, Brian. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, not at all. I you know, Demolition has such an interesting history within WWE. I mean, if you think about the original team, you know, which was Bill Eadie, Demolition Axe, Masked Superstar, and one of the Moondogs.
Right.
And it's actually funny because if you go back, and watch the Moondogs in Memphis, their finisher is that decapitation elbow. And then you fast forward to WWE, and their original manager is Luscious Johnny Valiant, who we spoke about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And then Moondog Smash leaves the tandem. Then Barry Darso comes in, who had a great career in Crockett, and was a great tag team wrestler. And then they went in. Like, I know that they looked like the Road Warriors, obviously with their appearance, but they were a great team. I mean, their matches were excellent. I really enjoyed them. And then the crush aspect of it later on, I think the timing of that, the Road Warriors came in and just kind of reigned and ruled there. So, the Demolition as a team has a very interesting history in the WWE.
And that's a long-standing, it's not really a bit on the show, too, is the Demolition versus Road Warriors. There's like the contingent who says, no, they're absolutely nothing alike, just the face paint. Completely different wrestlers, and some who say, they're just a blatant ripoff of the Road Warriors. I think that was really early on in your guys' show a couple years ago that you would talk about that.
Yeah, well, Scott always contended that he thought the Powers of Pain were more the Road Warriors knockoffs more than Demolition, right, Scott?
Yes, I did. Dr. G is the one that always says that Demolition was a blatant Road Warrior knockoff, and I always said that the Powers of Pain are much closer than Demolition. I mean, yeah, they're all the same. I mean, they're leather-clad guys with rocking entrance themes and spiked leather things and face paint. So I guess it really is all pretty close. But Brian, I don't remember if we talked about this the last time you were on. As I'm thumbing through the first encyclopedia, there's one person on this list in the book that really took me aback, and I forgot he was in here. And I know the first edition of the book was 2008. And I'm thumbing through the pages. One guy popped up at me, and I'm curious to see what curious to hear from you what the discussions were about putting this guy in here. And that guy is Chris mm-hmm. Benoit.
Okay.
Chris Benoit's in here, and this book came out. I believe the first edition came out maybe a year after what happened. What were the discussions about having him? Obviously, it doesn't mention any of it, of course. But what were the discussions about having him in the book?
There weren't really any. The idea, the idea around the book was, anybody that appeared on air in WWE. So, he had a WWE career. He was, so he was on the entry list. I wrote his entry, so I just tried to be as sensitive as I could with it. And, and that was really it. I mean, it was, it was just one of those things where, because, he was part of the company's history. So.
Interesting. And the entry is excellent. I just was perusing it for a moment. It did a wonderful job.
Yeah,
did a great job.
Thank you. Listen, it was very difficult. I mean, he was one of my favorites throughout his career, whether he was, wrestling in the United States, Canada, or Japan, or Mexico. And it was just one of those things where I just, wanted to, approach it with, just with a delicate mindset and try and do the best I could with it. If you look at the size of his entry, it's, I think appropriate given the amount of years he was in the WWE, as opposed to his entire career. He didn't wrestle his entire career in WWE. So,
right.
As far as I knew, myself, co-author Kevin Sullivan, there were, there were never discussions on, you know, if he should be in or not, or anything like that. It was just, you know, he's on the entry list, and, you know, I ended up being the one to write his entry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. Now, what about the pug, Alex Porto? Of course, it was a lot tougher to put him in than it was to put Chris Benoit in.
It's actually funny. I was reminded of him on ESPN Classics. They're running those Global Wrestling Federation shows from the Sportatorium, and I actually was reminded about him since the Encyclopedia, watching those, and you know, and that's another, you know, the that's one of the fun things about the Encyclopedia is that, like, you can just, you know, get together with your buddies and sit around and, you know, page through the book, and those are the kind of things that you know, that you remember, you know, the people that were in the company for a little while, you know, they were on TV, you remember them, and, you know, I mean, how do you forget Alex, right?
He was an Action Zone stalwart.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, that was a interesting time, too. I think we talked about this before, about how they were bringing in all those name guys to help put over their bigger name stars. So it was a shrewd move. That instead of using jobbers, they basically brought these guys in that would win matches on the syndicated shows, Superstars and Action Zone, and then put over the real name guys on Raw. So that was kind of their role, and they were veterans. They knew how to work a match and put a guy over. So it was a shrewd move at the time, and they stuck them all with interesting gimmicks like T.L. Hopper and Salvatore Sincere, Freddie Joe Floyd, and the Pug, of course, Alex Porto. All those guys kind of came in at the same time, and like very kind of like the fall of '96 was that reboot where they brought all those guys in. They're cleaning house.
Yes. Yes. And but what's the game plan, Brian? I think we brought this up on the last show, but I wasn't sure last time you were on. What is the timeline for maybe a third edition of the Encyclopedia? Like I admit, is there a timeline with WWE where you're going to kind of refresh it every 3 years probably? What's the game plan, do you think?
That I'm not sure. I hope so. I think that's a great idea. Conveniently, but
yes.
You know, I don't know of any plans right now for a new encyclopedia. But I do hope that there will get to be a third edition, and that I get to work on it again, and that I get to work on it with, you know, with co-author Kevin Sullivan. You know, I have to tell you guys, it's such a great project to be part of, and it's just a lot of fun, you know, so to be able to work on these, you definitely feel fortunate. So I do hope that there are plans for a third edition.
Anyway, Brian, just, you know, talking about it, going through it, it does trigger memories of, you know, Alex Porto. Like, that's like a specific point in your wrestling fandom where I can trace back to, oh, Alex Porto, Action Zone, sophomore year in my dorm, and like watching on my little 13-inch screen and trying to think if I should go downstairs and get breakfast or miss breakfast and watch the end of the match. You know, these little specific memories that it just triggers. You know, looking at some of these smaller gimmicks, when if you're looking at, say, a Randy Orton or a, you know, an Undertaker, it's hard to look at it. It's such a huge career and think of those particular memories. These little things here and there, these little gimmicks, they trigger those little points that you forget about.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's so interesting what resonates with people, and I think especially with professional wrestling in WWE and, you know, as it's known, sports entertainment, it's one of these areas of interest where if you ever watched it or you've ever seen it, you remember it. And that's a pretty powerful thing. I think in general, whether you're talking any area of interest you're talking about, you know, and I think, that's another thing that I love about working on this project and getting to, you know, speak to other fans and go on great shows like this is, you know, everybody has that moment where they remember who they saw, what they saw, and it sticks, you know, it sticks with them. So it's a very cool, very, very cool thing.
All right, Brian, I want to thank you once again for joining us here tonight. Had a great time, and we need to have you back more often because there's so many stories, and I think another thing we need to delve in is just do a whole show. We'll have Brad on with this. He's the video game junkies. Have you on and get it into more of the Acclaim stuff even more than we did tonight. Go through the games and more in depth and talk about that. I think that'd be a cool kind of concept show for us to have you on with next time. How's that sound?
Guys, I have to tell you, I can't thank you enough for having me on. This is my second time on the show. It's awesome. And it's always fun talking to you guys. And I'll come back anytime you'll have me. And and specifically to kick it old school and talk about the Acclaim days would definitely be a lot of fun. So so just let me know.
Of course we will, and you will definitely have you back on. So why don't we quickly take a break, and while we're on the break, you guys can click over to placemanation.com, hit the Amazon link on the right-hand side, go to Amazon and order the Doty Encyclopedia written by Brian Shields and Kevin Sullivan. So be sure to go ahead and grab the second edition, and you want to get it now, read it, memorize it, and the third edition will be out by the time you do. So with that, let's take a quick break. We're going to let Brian go, and we'll be right back to wrap things up.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What I'd like to have right now.
Chad, do you ever feel that the world revolves around WWF?
I think you mean WWE there, Barf.
Yeah, whatever, but what about David Crockett?
He likes it!
Well, what about Jimmy Valiant?
I'm gonna get you all until I get you, Paul Jones. Ooh.
The Four Horsemen.
We are a family, and we are the best.
The Omni, the Dangerous Alliance.
Please welcome the newest members of the Dangerous Alliance, Arn Anderson and Larry Zbysko.
Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express.
The Fantastics are putting the U.S. Tag Team title on the line against the Midnight Express.
Main events with actual work rate in them.
Woo! 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 All right!
It's just not fair to Flair.
It's not fair for Flair.
If this is what you're looking for, please check out Where the Big Boys Play podcast, the only pure NWA and WCW supercard podcast out there.
While you were in Hollywood making movies, Thunder Lips, I was winning world titles.
Well, there they are, our good friends Chad and Parr, Where the Big Boys Play. If you want nonstop old school NWA discussion, getting back to that very first Starrcade, these guys have it covered. Even the PICs have made an appearance once. We are very particular what podcasts we visit. So check out our friends Chad and Parr, Where the Big Boys Play. Their link is right on our site, placetobenation.com. Just go into the podcast menu. And there they are, with the other great shows we partner with. Chad and Parr, working Where the Big Boys Play. Speaking of Place to Be Nation, that's your everyday home for your pop culture needs. At placetobenation.com, we have everything. Wrestling, sports, comics, even polls. We want your opinions as well. Every day there's something different with our top staff of writers who are experts in all fields of pop culture. From the weekly Raw review to the return of the hack, we've got everything you need. We're also working with a myriad of great podcasts, of course, besides Chad and Parr. We have Grapple Talk, the fans podcast, Off the Top Rope, Answering the 10 Count, We Found New Music, and the Kings of Sport with Nate Milton. We've got everything for your listening pleasure. So check us out every day of the week at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Now, don't forget about our good friend Graham Cawthon and the history of WWE.com. He's still the top source for all argument solvers, from match results to house show cards to pay-per-view histories. Any questions you need answered, any debates among wrestling fans that need ending, head over to Graham's treasure trove of information. You will certainly find it. Need to know what the opener of Starrcade 1995 was? What was the main event of that 1988 Boston Garden house show you went to when you were 11 years old? Graham can tell you. He has WWE, WCW, ECW results, and the growing results in TNA and Ring of Honor. So for all your wrestling research needs, check out Graham Cawthon at thehistoryofwwe.com. Now finally, if you want a place to just hang out, discuss all things wrestling with fellow diehard fans, check out the news and the great forums at twfnews.com. They have all the up-to-the-minute stories in WWE, TNA, and pretty much everywhere in between. They talk old school, Attitude Era, and even those hard-to-remember guys and shows like Waylon Mercy or In Your House Number 3. So check out all there is to see right on twfnews.com.
J.J. Dillon, the leader of the Four Horsemen, and you're listening to Place to Be Podcast.
All right, Nation, we are back. I hope you enjoyed our second chat there with Brian Shields, a guy that has a lot of cool stories, have seen and been involved with a lot of cool things in the history of wrestling, and we'll definitely have him back. I'd love to have him come back. We'll talk some wrestling video games. I think that'd be a lot of fun. PlaceToBeNation.com, all three of us right here on the staff. Let me just run through some of the articles you may have missed since the last time we chatted, Scott. We have Russell Sellers with the newest Sellers Point, looking at the second golden age of comics, and that's what Steve had mentioned earlier. Wayne May takes a look at Nas and the greatest discography in hip-hop history, in his eyes. So if you're a Nas fan, check that out. Chad Campbell looked at boxing's biggest problem in the wake of the big fight this weekend and the loss by Mr. Broner. He gets into what could be boxing's main issue here as we head into 2014. Jeremy Nichols with the new Hasahara, The Faces of Death from 1978. Brad led the live blog of TLC 2013 last night. Scott, you and I were involved in that, but Brad did a yeoman's work carrying us through that show. So if you want to kind of relive and get our thoughts, you can go ahead and check that out. It's on the main page, placemanation.com. Total Divas watching Total Divas Season 2, Week 5. This is leading into the finale, which was last night. So Jen and Ben will be back this week with the finale. But if you want to get the penultimate episode, you can check that out from last week. Scott, of course, your TLC 2013 preview. For newer fans of the podcast, if you are a fan of Ring of Honor, and even if you're not, Eddie Edwards wrestled what looked to be his last match at Final Battle this past Saturday night. And we actually interviewed him, Scott, over 2 years ago. Yep. June 2011, he had just lost the Ring of Honor title to Davey Richards. Mm-hmm. We had him on the show the next night. And it was a good chat with Eddie, so we kind of reposted that for people to relive here on the end of his Ring of Honor run, if you want to go back and relive that interview. Jordan Duncan did a Survivor 27 report card. He's a Survivor nut, breaks down basically all the players and what he looks to have as we hit the finale here as well. The BCS Busters, our college football staff, looked at 1998 to 2000. And the flawed BCS era. They kind of went back and you guys relived some of the biggest games and memories.
Yep, and we kind of instituted what would have happened if the 4-team playoff had happened back then and who the 4 teams would have been. So coming up is 2001, 2002, and 2003 with myself, Mr. Reich, and Mr. Nick Duke. So
very cool. Yes. Steve Willey's Impact Report is up there. Matt Petticord SmackDown, Dan McGinn Superstars, Ryan Everett's main event. And, of course, Scott Keith's NXT is up there as well. All of your weekly recaps, all of your podcasts, and the new cool thing we have at PlaceToBeNation.com, right on the right-hand side, a ginormous logo. You can't miss it. You click that, it takes you to the main podcast home.
Yes.
And you can just click on any podcast you want. It brings up the full archive right there for you. So if you're a podcast fan, you want to go right over to that, you just click that button. It brings you to our podcast archive. So please, come visit us, PlaceToBeNation.com. If you're interested in writing, let us know. You can email us, JustinR@PlaceToBeNation.com, Scott C, PlaceToBeNation.com, or just info@PlaceToBeNation.com as well. And we can check out your sample and see if you pass the test.
Yes.
All right, guys, we're going to go ahead and wrap things up. Steve Willey, I want to thank you so much for having joined us here tonight to chat with Mr. Brian Shields. Mm-hmm. You were an invaluable part of the show.
Well, thank you.
And Scott, you are a somewhat valuable part of the show. So
oh, God.
Here as well. And we'll be back Wednesday night. Kevin Kelly, a very important time in WWF history.
Yes.
First half of 2001, we've reviewed on our Vintage Vaults through King of the Ring. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have Kevin on. We're going to recap Final Battle 2013 with him. Mm-hmm. And then we'll get into the first half of 01. It's been a while since we have a Kevin on, so we're looking forward to chatting with him. And then next week, Scott, we'll have our Christmas episode. Some cool stuff planned, as you mentioned earlier. And then we'll kind of set you up from there with what we have the rest of the year into the new year. It's going to be a while before we have another Vintage Vault, but that's because we have a lot of cool things planned for you. So for Steve Willey, for Brian Shields, for Scott Criscolo, I am Justin Rosero. PTB Nation will talk to you Wednesday night with Kevin Kelly. Take care. That's it. Nothing snarky, Mr. Snark Star Man? Snark Star?
No. Wanted it to be clean. Joel, in honor of Jose LeDuc.
Jose LeDuc is never clean. Jose LeDuc.
Jose LeDuc and Buck Quartermain. What a tag team.
Yes, the Explorers.